You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, Michael Olson here for appellant Beverly Mack. I believe this is a pretty straightforward matter that we're looking at. This comes on a civil suit for assault and battery. The finding of liability is not an issue. Where we get the issue is once the jury is sent to compute damages. It's clear from the record that attorney's fees were not, no evidence was put on for attorney's fees, and in this type of case, you know, attorney's fees, based on well-established case law, just are not awardable in this matter. However, the first time the jury comes back, they ask if they can add attorney's fees. They aren't given any specific directions. They're just said to fill out the paper. Then they come back with a verdict, $1 for the battery, and plus, and they put next to it, plus legal fees not to exceed $35,000. When that comes back, there's an indication of exactly what the jury is trying to do. The jury is trying to award $1 for the verdict plus those attorney's fees, which in no case like this are allowed, no evidence was pled. Again, they aren't given any instruction on that. They're just told, you know, to put it on the verdict form. That's the only thing they got. And then they finally came back with a verdict of $35,001 for battery, and of course $1 for
battery. Can I just jump to something that your opposing counsel argues, and that is, when you asked the trial court for an instruction, which the court didn't give. But they say, but then after that, you waive the argument by essentially signing off on what the jury did, and that therefore the argument was forfeited. Can you help us with that?
Well, I disagree with that. On the final order, there was an objection written on the final order. You know, it was a case where, you know, the judge has made the finding. You know, we can't just refuse to sign the order of the judge. So we feel that that it was preserved both on the record and through the specific objection made on the order, which the language was included in our brief. And I think that adequately preserved the record on that.
May I ask you as well, if you succeed on appeal, why wouldn't the right answer be a remand for liability and damages as opposed to damages? Because the final verdict was assault was a $1 compensatory award, which under our precedent is essentially a defense verdict on liability in some circumstances. So since we don't know exactly what they were thinking, why wouldn't it be a remand for everything?
Well, you know, in a perfect world, it would be, but we're just taking the economy into the fact.
We're striving for that.
And that, you know, it just costs so much money to retry, you know, these cases with a jury that, you know, in all fairness, it's better for our client that, you know, if we just, you know, take the $3 plus the court cost and, you know, just call it a day rather than...
Well, it would be highly efficient for his client if we just rejected your appeal, so that can't be the objective ground for decision.
True. So, you know, if the court finds it appropriate, you know, we would ask that it be remanded for just a general retrial, but we think that the error didn't only occur in the damages section. Because, you know, we believe that it's clear that the jury didn't understand the instructions on that, and that the judge, you know, should have recognized that, like we immediately recognized, and he should have instructed the jury as to what the correct law is, because, you know, this comes out at the end that a verdict adding those, lumping those attorney's fees in with the compensatory damages, you know, it's just contrary to the law and to what evidence was presented. So, you know, we believe that the case law is clear that you know, that it's reversible error when the judge fails to add those instructions to the jury when they are clearly mistaken on the law and are not correctly applying it. And as far as the instruction itself, I guess the fact that it's refused, that's generally from the law found, you know, in the light most favorable to the party requesting the instruction. So I believe that our requests, as well as the evidence, show that, you know, the instruction should have been given to clarify to the jurors, and that it should be reversed and remanded based on that. I'd like to, if there are no questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
May it please the court. My name is Frank Edgar, and I represent the appellee, Garrick Blount. I want to address the questions of Justice McCullough. I think you asked the, you pointed out the first half of my brief, and let me be candid. I believe the long-sitting circuit judge, Wilfred Taylor, handled this the best way he could, and I think he handled it perfectly appropriately. And I think he would be surprised that Mr. Shea thought he had preserved an objection in the way Mr. Shea handled the colloquy that Judge Taylor had with counsel before he brought the jury in after the first verdict form had been returned. I know that the statute 801.384 and 5:25 of the rule have relaxed the formality standards, but there are still standards to preserve an appeal, a point on appeal in this Commonwealth. And I don't believe those standards have been relaxed to the level of Mr. Shea's, it was Ms. Mack's counsel at trial, his, the way he handled this.
But what more do you have to do? You ask for a jury instruction and the judge says no.
But I think, to go back to, and I'm going to address both questions in at one time, I'm not aware of any case where the court has addressed this issue in a vacuum. In other words, I didn't get a jury instruction back here, and then after the verdict comes back, to say, well, I accept that verdict. That verdict, he not only...
He accepted the verdict?
I made a motion to enter judgment on the verdict, and he consented to that motion. He did not object to that motion.
Well, you don't have to keep objecting if you've objected once and you got hosed.
My point is, I'm not aware of a case where you can look back and just pick out comments made, you know, prior to the verdict coming in and say that those comments somehow are preserved purely as a esoteric act. In other words, the argument made in the brief is that this verdict reflects this problem.
Well, suppose someone objects to evidence during a trial and says, I object, overruled. Well, let me proffer my objection. Okay, fine, proffer it, Mr. Kelsey. You proffer it, you go for three more days, and you lose. Do you have to keep mentioning, do you remember, Judge, in the second day of trial I objected to this evidence?
No, I think you have to, though, say, at least at some point, say, well, the ultimate verdict or the outcome is been impacted by that error. There's got to be, there's lots of decisions made by a court during a trial, but you've got to say at the end that result is impacted by that error. And I'm asking this court, or I'm asking the circuit court first to do something, to make a motion to set aside. I mean, all the cases cited that I find by the plaintiff, the Rice, the Johnson, the Stump case, they're all motions to set aside verdict, motions for new trial. Motion to set aside the verdict is inadequate. Motion to set aside the verdict. Even the Alabama case that was quoted by the appellant in this matter has that post-trial motion to talk about how the two connect. Here, otherwise you're left with pure speculation. I think Mr. Shea...
Speculation as to what, counsel?
Pure speculation that the error had any impact at all on the outcome of the case.
But the question here is preservation. Whether it had any impact on the outcome is an appellate question as to whether or not it's harmless error. So why does he have to do what you're asking to do at the trial court when it's what we do at the appellate court?
Because I think at least you have to give Judge Taylor a chance to address the issue in the circuit court.
Counsel, no less than five times he tells Judge Taylor, you can't give legal fees. They didn't ask for legal fees. This is a judgment for legal fees. You have to give me a mistrial. You have to instruct them. No less than five times. Why? And he records it then on the final order. What is it that you're suggesting that he has to do?
I think he has to object even sending the verdict form back. I think he has to make an objection to saying, Judge, you've got to enter judgment on the verdict striking those words legal fees and enter judgment on the dollar.
Judge, they didn't give compensatory damages. They gave legal fees. The last comment that he makes before Judge Taylor says, well, should I give him a blank form or should I give him the old form?
Actually, Judge Taylor then before that says, well, I acknowledge what you're telling me, and this is I'm going to fix this. And he tells him the plan to fix it. And Mr. Shea says, well, the blank form is fine. Blank, just second
just
page
is right
fine.
Before that, he says, Judge, they didn't give compensatory damages. They gave legal fees. That's
right. I recall that. What I'm saying is that at that point, the judge is giving him his plan to fix it. And he doesn't say, when he understands that the judge is going to give it back, he doesn't say, hey, you can't give it back. I make the objection, you can't give it back to them. And instead he says, well, give them the blank form. Give him the second page only. So I think that constitutes a waiver of his right to pursue it now, especially when you take in the fact that when the jury comes back with a verdict that he now believes is tainted, he doesn't make an objection.
Right, but if the problem isn't the form, the standard verdict form that just says write a number for the damages, if the problem is you should have, the jury's misinformed because they don't know about the American rule and all that. So what the lawyer's saying is you just need to inform them, instruct them that you don't get attorney's fees in this situation. The court says, no, I'm not doing that. And so the problem isn't the court or the lawyer signing off on the standard verdict form. The problem is the court not instructing the jury that they're about their misapprehension. So it seems like they're just separate things.
Well, I understand that. And obviously, you know, I'm in a spot at trial where the judge is having a colloquy with opposing counsel myself saying this is how I'm going to fix it. And as you note, I don't jump in and say, well, Mr. Shea is wrong. I just say, you've got to give it back to them. They have the definition of compensatory damages. And that's the one thing the record can't reflect is Judge Taylor's inflection of his voice, because he's saying to the jury, I want you to tell me how much compensatory damages there are. That's what he says to them.
And you know, if he had left it at that, you might have a stronger position, at least as far as I'm concerned. But then he goes on to say, you have to give me a numeral, I think it's the word that you're all using, on this line, which then seems to muddle what he is telling them
about. No question, there's two sentences, yes. He said, but he is correct in saying compensatory damages. I want the amount of compensatory damages, he says. And then you have to, so, and then
what you determine that they don't know that compensatory damages doesn't include legal fees. I mean, the man testified he had a bunch of legal fees. So maybe they thought, as the English do, that it is part of compensatory damages.
Well, again, I don't know what the jury thought. The term legal fees came up in the case once. It was not objected to by Mr. Shea at all. It came up as referring to past experiences with this same.
But the point is, as Justice Powell was suggesting, when they come back and say, look, legal fees not to exceed blank, well, $35,000 or whatever, legal fees not to exceed, and then the judge tells the jurors, well, you've got to give me a number, I would think that would sort of almost indirectly affirm, okay, well, between zero and 35 in legal fees, we've got to come up with a number. It almost made it worse in a sense. If you start off with the false premise that compensatories could theoretically include legal fees, which a layperson could, and in fact, as you know, there are exceptions to the American rule where we do exactly that, where legal fees are properly characterized as compensatory damages in certain third-party litigation scenarios.
Well, I think that would surprise Judge Taylor as it surprised me. I think at the time, Judge Taylor thought he says, fix this. He is aware of the situation, and he puts out his fix, which is to tell them, I want compensatory damages, and as the court knows, those damages are defined clearly in the instructions agreed to by both parties. But, I mean, I understand.
But surely the final verdict form suggests it wasn't fixed. It may have been intended to be a fix, but the fix didn't work.
Well, to say that, you have to go back. I mean, I understand that there is indications, at least the indication there at the time, but that the jury may do that. But there's also the fact that the jury had heard all the evidence about the general damages suffered by the plaintiff. General damages that don't come with receipts, sorrow, humiliation, embarrassment.
But isn't the problem with your position regarding that is they heard all that and they said general damages, $1.
They didn't. They said that. They do separate it, but I think, again, you have to make the assumption that's what they meant.
Why do we have to assume it when they say in legal fees of no more than $35,000?
Plus a
dollar.
What's
the assumption?
So I think that the phrase was legal fees not to exceed $35,000 plus a dollar. So I don't know how you can, other than saying it's all legal fees, I don't know how you could parse it out without presuming
legal fees not to exceed $35,000 plus
a dollar.
$1.
Well, right.
$35,000 is for legal fees, the dollars for everything else.
Well, that I mean, again,
that's what he says.
I know. Trust me, I tried the case the whole day and I end up with this. And I think it surprised Judge Taylor, but I know he certainly tried to fix it.
Oh, no doubt.
And there's no question he told them compensatory damages, and there's no question that compensatory damages is defined in the instruction.
But it seems like he certainly was trying to fix it, and everybody was working on fixing it. But Mr. Mack, on at least five occasions, said, and you almost have to give him credit for pushing back against the judge, because the judge is kind of like, why don't I just do this? He says, no, Judge, you got to tell him that compensatory damages do not include attorney's fees. It's okay, well, why don't I just do this? He says, Judge, I don't agree with you, Judge. You got to tell him it's attorney's fees. Well, you know, I was thinking we could do so-and-so. Judge, I don't think you can say that. I mean, like five times he said, no, I don't think that's the way to fix it. No, I don't think that's the way to fix it. No, I don't think that's the way to fix it.
Well, in fairness to Judge Taylor, I think often Mr. Shea was referring to the way it had come out of the jury the first time. The first question, I mean, you have counsel that's arguing before you today. I mean, he's calling the answer to the first jury question, what do you call it, ambiguous and misleading, and it was his answer. Mr. Shea approved the answer to the jury the first time. So we get that. And I think that kind of starts down this path where Mr. Shea is trying to have everything. I hear you loud and clear. All I can say is I know he was trying to fix it. I know that he said compensatory damages.
If we determine it's not fixed, what's your position?
Then I don't think he abused the discretion in not giving it. In not giving us additional instruction.
Okay, if we determine that it wasn't fixed, that the jury gave $35,000 in attorney's fees, maybe, what do we do with this case if we think it goes back or does it go back? Do we award a dollar here? Do we send it back for damages? Do we send it back for full trial? What is your position?
Well, getting to the end of what appeared to be my case, I think you have to send it back for trial on damages. I think the jury has to be given a chance to address the damages suffered by the plaintiff on his battery case. I don't think that's a full day trial by any means, but I do think you have to go back since there is, if the court finds that, one, the appeal is preserved, two, there's confusion and the judge should have given the additional instruction and it popped up, it resulted in the verdict of $35,001 in compensatory damages, then that issue needs to go back to a jury to be tried on
but
damages.
But the compensatory damage award was $1 against the defendant, right?
I don't agree with that, Justice Kelsey.
Okay, well, for the sake of argument, assume that I do. if it's $1, that's translated as a defense verdict. So if we were to only remand it for damages, we're taking away what would otherwise in law be characterized as a defense verdict thus perversely expressed, is the language of the case, the leading case. So why wouldn't it go back for liability and damages?
Because I think liability is established. I think the defendant has conceded liability. I don't think...
They've conceded it?
Well, they want it sent back for damages if that's one of their opportunities, or they want you to just award a dollar. There doesn't seem to be any reference in any brief from the appellant that they want full-blown trial on this again, and Mr. Olson said no.
Why wouldn't you just award a dollar if it's $35,000 in attorney's fees plus $1, and attorney's fees were never pled nor could they be awarded?
Well, I think it was a reality at the time, Justice Powell. I think it was a reality that I certainly discussed with my clients that if this was a situation, it could come back as a dollar. But I think given the law, the cases cited and the ones that I could find, I think it needs to go back for a hearing on damages on the battery count.
Counsel, you know, I think my colleagues are asking you that given the choice between having a final judgment for $1 here and the opportunity to try the case again on liability, which would you choose?
Again, it's tough, Your Honor. That's a good question. My client and I were well aware of the possibility of receiving a dollar as the win, the victory. So if that's the court's decision, my client takes the victory. I don't look victory in the mouth. You know,
So you would pass up the opportunity, if given the choice, to try the case again on liability and damages in order to accept a $1 final judgment here?
Certainly at the time of this matter going on, we would.
All right. Well, that's about the most candid answer I've heard in a long while, and I appreciate it.
Thank well, Your Honor, I joined Judge Palin saying we tried to get this fixed. We tried this case all day, and I thought it was fixed. I know he thought it was fixed. I regret we have to be here for that.
All right. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
You have quite a bit of rebuttal time, should you find it necessary to use it.
I'll be very brief. In response, I did want to say that, you know, in our brief, we didn't ask for it to be remanded just for damages. You know, it says in the inclusion that, you know, we're asking for the $1 award or that be remanded for trial limited to the issues of liability and damages on the battery claim. So we weren't asking for it to be remanded for damages only.
Do I understand that you asked for the $1 or in the alternative remand?
Yes, we asked for
the $1.
Yes, and remanded for as the alternative.
Thank you.
It's a pretty good win to have a $1 verdict against you, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Call the next case.